I've come up with a great plan for how we can advance the cause of science. First, we find mentally disabled people who can't speak English. We need to make sure that they look very different from the average person, or we might feel sympathy for them. Then we do painful and sometimes fatal medical experiments on them. Think of what we could learn. Sound horrifying? Isn't that what we're doing every day in labs around the world to our closest genetic relatives, the great apes? Find out more about the campaign to give chimps, gorillas, and other great apes human-level protections under the law through the Great Ape Project, www.greatapeproject.org. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Jay Hughes, a.k.a. Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Are you curious what the true face of compassionate conservatism might be? J.R. Lab, a columnist for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, reports that in the name of instilling patriotism in public school pupils, Texas legislators want to mandate daily recitations of the Pledge of Allegiance and the preamble to the Declaration of Independence. Only students who have written notes from their parents requesting exemptions would be excused from the exercise. One of the sponsors said that he struggled with crafting his proposal, especially considering that he said, "I'm one who hates to see government require anything," but he justified it by paraphrasing Aristotle's maxim on citizenship, saying, "The job of education is not just to impart knowledge, but to make good citizens," and the pledge would instill daily the importance of loyalty and patriotism. Already, 32 other states already have in place some form of legislation about the pledge. Of course, 20 require that the pledge be said either daily or periodically. As Lab points out, perhaps the mandatory recitation of the five freedoms guaranteed in the First Amendment is more in order. MSNBC has published a nice piece summarizing the voting technologies in use around the country using research gathered by a White House-commissioned one-year study of the feasibility of electronic voting last December. More than one-third of Americans were still using punch cards in the 1996 election, and another quarter of voters are marking on ballots that are read by machines. Both of these methods are prone to being misread by machines. Only 8% of voters were using electronic methods in 1996, and none of these were connected to the Internet. In this last election, however, several hundred military personnel who were registered in one of the five U.S. locations but were stationed overseas were able to cast ballots from computers using special, secure software. Salon.com has a nice article summarizing the failure of a market in electoral futures to predict the outcome of this election. A decade ago, the University of Iowa received a special waiver to allow gambling on U.S. elections, and the Iowa electronic markets were born to test the theory that the current price of any commodity in an exchange market reflects the total amount of information available at the time. There are actually two presidential markets in Iowa. The more popular version is called the winner-take-all market, in which investors buy futures contracts that pay $1 each on November 10th if your chosen candidate wins the popular vote, as reported by the New York Times that morning. The other market is called the vote share market, and it pays out $1 multiplied by the proportion of the popular vote received by that candidate on the same day. So if you bought Bush vote share futures at 40 cents apiece, and then he garnered 48% of the popular vote, you'd walk off with 8 cents for each contract that you owned. This year, both methods failed. As Bush and Gore quibble over who claims the presidency, the Iowa election markets seem to mimic the confusion, delivering two contradictory results. Iowa's winner-take-all market pegged Bush as the clear winner, with confidence in a Bush win soaring in the days before the election. But on election day, the market swung wildly and finally flipped to favor Gore. The ambivalence held. Even as late as November 10th, the day the market closed, Gore futures were selling for 96.9 cents, not the full dollar they should have cost, given the payout. The vote share market was more stable, but closed at an anomalous pricing of 49.1 cents for Bush and 48.1 cents for Gore. So why did the markets fail? First of all, politics pollutes markets. People are more likely to vote for their preferred candidate regardless of their chances. Secondly, inequality matters. On average, Bush supporters are wealthier than Gore supporters. Therefore, they can afford to be less risk-averse than the Gore camp. Another reason why the Iowa markets failed relates to the use of futures to hedge risk. If I'm on the 1% of Americans, top 1% of American earners, who stands to gain enormously from a Bush election, I may want to insure myself against his loss by purchasing Gore futures. This would suggest that investors would bet against their preferences and or predictions. Whichever way the election turns out, economists should take note, markets are not all-knowing or all-powerful. There is a constant battle between the passions and the interests, and sometimes the passions win. Markets cannot be universally relied on to predict the future any more than religion, astrology, or genetics can. And that's from an article in Salon.com. Following on recent British research that demonstrated marked similarities between a desire for spicy Indian food and drug addiction, a team at the University of Bremen, publishing in Medical Psychiatry, has found that when gamblers play for money, they have the physiological and psychological reactions, such as the release of psychoactive hormones, similar to drug addiction. Drug warriors are reluctant to accept these connections, however, since, as one researcher put it, if you can get addicted to a behavior like gambling, you can get addicted to gardening. And an addiction to cards may not be such a bad thing. Marion Cleaves Diamond, a neuroscientist at the University of California, Berkeley, presented the findings at an annual meeting of the Society for Neuroscience in New Orleans that 90 minutes of play at brainy card games such as Contract Bridge increased production of immune cells. Bridge involves skills stimulating a part of the brain called the dorsolateral cortex, which is part of the frontal lobe that earlier animal research suggests may play a role in the immune system. Dr. Luc Deliens of Brussels has found that 1 in 10 Belgian doctors acknowledge giving drugs to patients to hasten their deaths, often without formal consent, although euthanasia is illegal in Belgium. 3% of all deaths involved administration of legal drugs without patients' consent. And they said the study raised questions about why doctors in Belgium and Australia were more likely than doctors in Holland to intentionally end the lives of their patients without an explicit request. A parallel study in Holland, where physician-assisted suicide is legal, but only with the patient's consent, found the same rate of assisted deaths, but a much lower rate of euthanasia without patient's consent. When physician-assisted suicide is legal, physicians and patients discuss it openly, and physicians are less likely to pursue the route of mercy killing. Of course, facts do not tell a clear story to partisans. Ezekiel Emanuel, the chief ethicist for the NIH, and who is married to the chief ethicist for the AMA, Linda Emanuel, has published the results of a study tracking the decisions of terminally ill Americans. Just as many studies have shown that 70% of Americans think that terminally ill people in pain should be able to end their lives with a doctor's help if needed, so 60% of Emanuel's 1,000 subjects said that euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide should be an option. Only 10.6% said that they would consider it for themselves. 2 to 6 months later, however, half of those people had abandoned the idea, and an additional 3% who had not initially considered ending their lives started considering it. So overall, about 14% of the terminally ill people that they tracked considered suicide for themselves at some point. In the end, however, only 1.6% of patients discussed the option with their doctors, and only 2.5% hoarded painkillers in case they decided to try suicide. Of course, this is in a context of a physician-assisted suicide being illegal. Only a quarter of the subjects had died by the end of the six-month period, and only one of those was a physician-assisted suicide. Emanuel's conclusion, since he's opposed to physician-assisted suicide, is that assisted suicide doesn't need to be legalized, since it will only improve care for the fraction of those who want it. Of course, one can also conclude that it should be legalized, since the majority want it to be, and a significant minority would like it to be available as one of their options. Oregon is the only state in which physician-assisted suicide is legal. 43 people have used the law to die since it passed in 1997. Maine voters rejected a similar law 2 weeks ago after an intensive Catholic campaign. A story in the Washington Post of November 17 reports on the growing practice of doctors inseminating wives with the sperm of their father-in-laws when the husband is infertile. This is happening in Japan. These offspring, whose fathers are their own grandfathers, that is, their biological fathers are their relational grandfathers, permit an unbroken bloodline, which is central to the Shinto Buddhist system of ancestral obligations in Japan. The procedure is legal in the United States, although as yet unknown, where artificial insemination is largely unregulated. In Japan, the procedure has split the medical community, and the Japanese Health and Welfare Ministry is considering permitting the practice, even though the Japanese prohibit surrogate motherhood, in vitro fertilization using donated sperm, and any donation of a woman's egg or embryo, all of which are common procedures in the United States. The Japanese royal family have yet to conceive a child after several years of marriage, and the prince's father is still alive, so the procedure may actually be of some use to them. You're listening to Dr. J with Change Surfer Radio. We're doing a special News of the Future today. I was giving my various guests a break so that they could enjoy Thanksgiving in peace. The BBC reports that a biotechnology company has acquired the exclusive rights to research the genetic makeup of people living on the South Pacific island of Tonga. Researchers at the Melbourne-based Autogen want to study the remote community to trace the genes that cause particular diseases. The biotechnology wing of the Australian company will take the DNA and blood samples from among Tonga's 108,000 inhabitants. Populations on remote islands are ideal for genetic researchers since their communities are fairly static, and families can easily trace back their family trees over several generations. As a result, scientists can more easily identify which genes are linked to common diseases and how they spread through the community over time. The company has promised that if genetic research leads to any new patented drugs or treatments, the people of Tonga will share in the profits. Iceland, which also has a comparatively settled community over generations, has given a medical research company access to the island's medical and genealogical records. A report in the Chicago Tribune describes how Chicago-area parents of kids with a rare and lethal neurological disorder are suing the Miami Children's Hospital that patented a genetic test for the disorder on the grounds that since the test has made it more expensive and difficult for parents to get tested for the disorder, that they have violated the agreement with the parents. The hospital used blood and tissue from two Chicago-area children and others who died from the disease without telling the parents that they are being used to develop a test. The lawsuit marks the first time that tissue donors have taken researchers to court for the control of a gene. The suit does not directly challenge the patent, but instead alleges that the researchers secretly obtained it using the genetic information and financial resources that had been donated for the public good and began charging royalties and limiting the availability of testing. The families, along with the New York-based Canavan Foundation, Canavan's the name of the disorder, and other plaintiffs seek to block Miami Children's Hospital's commercial use of the Canavan gene and recover damages of more than $75,000 derived from royalties collected for the gene test. But the Canavan case goes beyond the disease. The bigger issue is how much the public has to say about the profits and other fruits of genetic research, especially when one considers that hundreds of similar tests are expected to be the initial payoffs from the $3 billion taxpayer-funded Human Genome Project. No gene test can be developed without the help of families battling the disease. The danger to the public of fixed licensing, as used here, according to experts, is in the stacking of royalties charged by all the patent holders of all the mutations identified in deleterious genes. Individually, the charges aren't much, but collectively they can be quite burdensome. In addition to the fixed royalty expense, Miami Children's Hospital restricted the number of laboratories that could use the test and the number of tests that could be performed each year. Over the past year, one in four laboratories has stopped performing certain genetic tests because of patent restrictions or excessive costs. Researchers in Korea and Canada have cured type 1 diabetes in mice and rats by injecting them with insulin-producing genetic factors. Research published in the journal Nature reports that doctors used a cold virus modified to carry the insulin-producing gene. The rats maintained normal insulin levels for 8 months without further treatment. The New Scientist is reporting on the progress of separate teams of nanotechnologists in designing medical nanobots. The nanobots would be released into the bloodstream to seek and destroy pathogens and cancer cells, or to target particular tissues or parts of the body for the precise delivery of drugs and hormones. A team from the Utah State University believed that flagella from bacteria such as Salmonella and E. coli may be the perfect motors for drug-filled nanosubmarines. The team hopes that their current computer simulations will be followed up with a prototype in a few months, probably using a wild strain of the Salmonella bacterium. A team at Cornell University has demonstrated that metal rotors can be powered by the body's natural fuel, ATP. When the biomotors were tested in the laboratory, they were able to drive the helicopter's propellers at 8 rotations per second for up to 2.5 hours. The propellers could propel virus-sized nanobots around the body. The process still needs some tweaking. Only 5 of the first 400 biomotors worked. Reuters is reporting on a growing number of companies planning to offer stem cell transplants into brains as a treatment for brain injuries and neurological diseases. At least 6 companies are planning to offer the therapy within 4 to 8 years. Treatments have been successful in rats, and human trials are underway. Till now, it took an average of 6 fetuses to harvest enough stem cells to treat a human brain, but stem cells can now be cultured in labs and generated from the patient's own cells. Stem cells can also be tweaked to divide indefinitely. Other firms are breeding transgenic pigs for harvesting of human-compatible stem cells. The BBC is reporting that British scientists have created the world's first truly bionic hand, small enough to be used by a toddler, and that it will soon be available through the socialist national health care system of the UK to poor and rich kids alike. The problem that they have solved is to make the motors and batteries small enough to be completely self-contained. The unit is operated by nerve signals to the brain. The user sends a signal to move a muscle in the forearm, and electrodes detect this and pass the message on to the motors. The team now plans to build bigger versions of the hand for use in adult patients. Meanwhile, Duke researchers are reporting in the journal Nature that they have successfully connected wires to neurons in a monkey's brain, allowing the monkey to control robotic arms. In the monkey experiment, 96 wires, each half the thickness of a human hair, were connected to 6 areas of one animal's brain, while 32 wires were connected to 2 areas of the second monkey's brain. The wire's signals were then interpreted by an external computer and used to control a robotic arm. The robotic arms performed simple to and fro motions, similarly with each monkey, but they performed 3-dimensional movements better when directed by the monkey with more implants. They are now working on a chip that could be implanted under the skin, replacing the external computer. Dr. Roy Bacay of Rush Presbyterian Hospital in Chicago, who helped develop a system to allow a paralyzed human to control a computer cursor with brain implants, said that devices to enable people to perform routine tasks could be developed rather quickly. But it will be a long time before artificial limbs can be made to perform more complex tasks, such as throwing a ball, he said. Such devices would have to be designed with fail-safe systems that would turn the device off during sleep or if the patient had a seizure. The equipment would also have to be made small enough to be portable. I would imagine that in the next decade, we'll see some prosthetic devices that are going to give patients the ability to do simple things such as turn on the TV, Bacay said. An article in Plant Physiology reports on success in genetically engineering tobacco plants to ooze foreign proteins, including vaccines, hormones, and plastics. Ilya Raskin and his colleagues at Rutgers University in New Jersey exploited the fact that during the night, leaves lose less moisture by evaporation and pressure builds up inside and squeezes fluid out, a process called guttation. So Raskin and his team genetically engineered tobacco plants to produce 3 foreign proteins in this intercellular fluid, including the green phosphorescent protein from jellyfish. In the future, the technique might be applied to other plants that produce large drops of guttation fluid, such as tomatoes and grasses. The drops could be sucked or shaken off the leaves each morning and processed to purify the proteins. Or, as in the production of some of the finest hashish, naked virgins could run through the fields and then have the resin scraped off their bodies. You're listening to Change Surfer Radio with Dr. J, special News of the Future program. This is exciting. Scientists in Wales said that they discovered what may be a tiny form of primitive alien life that a passing comet may have dropped into Earth's atmosphere. And this is reported in London Daily Mail newspaper yesterday. Researchers said that in a filter of a high-flying balloon operated by the Indian Space Research Organization, they found a strain of bacteria unlike anything on Earth. The bacteria were found at an altitude of 10 miles, and scientists from the ISRO, Cardiff University, and the University of Wales College of Medicine say that it may have come from a comet on a close approach to Earth, according to the Daily Mail. Professor Chandra Wickramasinghe, who is based at Cardiff University, said the discovery marked the first time that we have had direct evidence for the hypothesis that comets seed life on other planets. Wickramasinghe and astronomer Fred Hoyle suggested the theory of panspermia more than two decades ago, that is, that the seeds of life, either DNA or microbes, could be carried by asteroids or comets and dropped off on planets such as Earth to germinate life. The bacteria found in the balloon's filter is a hitherto unknown strain, Wickramasinghe said. It is so different from anything that we've seen before that there are only two possible explanations. One, he told the Daily Mail, is that organisms have been lifted from the Earth to great heights in the skies and have somehow multiplied there and changed over time. The second, he said, is that this is an example of primitive alien life. The university said that, the newspaper said that samples of the bacteria are under study at Cardiff's Astrobiology Center, which Wickramasinghe and other scientists from ISRO, Cardiff University, and the College of Medicine have teamed up to form. Wickramasinghe rejected suggestions that the bacteria might be the result of contamination by earthly organisms. He said ISRO had imposed stringent sterile conditions aboard the balloon. The most recent geological evidence now suggests that life on Earth may be 4 billion years old, the professor was quoted as saying. That is a very significant time, because it was a period when the Earth was pounded by comets and meteors. But his theory is not universally accepted in scientific circles. The Daily Mail quoted Alan Penny, an astronomer at Britain's Rutherford Appleton Laboratory, as warning that we would be cautious about jumping to conclusions. Extraordinary claims, he said, need extraordinary evidence. Turning Mars into a habitable planet may be a difficult but doable problem with today's technologies, said scientists at the Physics and Biology of Making Mars Habitable conference. This is in Mountain View, California. Making the uninhabitable planet habitable, a process known as terraforming, begins with raising its temperature, which is perhaps the easiest step. Scientists at the conference suggested that it could be accomplished within a century by pumping the atmosphere full of super greenhouse gases. The greenhouse gases would form a warming blanket around Mars, which would melt the planet's abundant supply of frozen carbon dioxide. Itself a greenhouse gas, the carbon dioxide would promote further warming while forming the basis of a pressurized atmosphere. This is, in fact, the basis of the plot of the novels Blue, Red, and Green Mars. Chris McKay, an astrobiologist at NASA's Ames Research Center, estimated that the surface of Mars could thaw in 100 years and the whole planet in about 700. While thawing, microbial and plant life could be introduced. However, at this stage, early life faces the problem of finding enough nitrogen to support life. Nitrogen is a key component of photosynthesis and essential for plant life. McKay told the conference that while preliminary analyses suggest that there may be enough nitrogen in Mars's atmosphere and soil to support a biosphere, it may not be enough in high enough concentrations to be absorbed and metabolized by microorganisms. McKay said that the temperature of Mars has to be raised only a few degrees to make it hospitable to the hardiest of Earth's microorganisms, which are species of lichen and algae found in Antarctica. He also suggested that special microbes may have to be genetically engineered. Julian Hiscox, a microbiologist at Reading University in England, said that it is possible to genetically engineer microbes to withstand low pressure, cold, and high levels of radiation, but it would be much more difficult to engineer an organism to deal with very low levels of nitrogen. The problem, Hiscox said, is that nitrogen fixing is controlled by at least 15 separate genes, and there may be hosts of other genes also involved. Nitrogen fixation is the showstopper, he said, but it's going to be very difficult. The biggest milestone in making Mars suitable for humans will be establishing trees on the red planet. Over tens of thousands of years, trees would pump enough oxygen into the atmosphere to make it breathable, scientists said. Martin Heath, an earth scientist at Greenwich Community College in London, said that Mars had enough sunlight and probably enough carbon to support Earth-like forests, but that he remains skeptical that they could be established. The problem is that you've got to change Mars dramatically to support trees, he said. One of the first animals introduced to Mars may be the one astronauts would most like to leave behind, cockroaches. Charles Cockell, a microbiologist with the British Antarctic Survey, said that cockroaches would make ideal biological maids for cleaning up after human colonists. Cockroaches are an excellent way to biologically control detritus. The earlier they are introduced, the better. Coquel said that other insects would also be necessary to pollinate plants and spread microorganisms like algae over the planet. They are also excellent sources of food. Insects are very high in protein, he said. In a series of experiments, Coquel found insects can survive ultra-low pressures, the kind of atmosphere that might be found on an early terraformed Mars. Coquel said his colleagues put about a dozen different species of insects, including roaches and ants, in a large vacuum box and sucked the air out. The scientists found that most insects still function at about 50 millibars, the equivalent pressure of about 70,000 feet in the air. The roach's body doubles in size, and the insect starts active breathing, Coquel said, but it still moves about and lays eggs. Insects could be introduced at the early stages, he said. At about 20 millibars, the mobility of the insect decreases and they expire. The extraordinary thing about these pressures is that they are extremely low, he said. A big problem for life on Mars is that the planet's lack of a tectonic system of shifting continental plates to recycle essential nutrients throughout the biosphere. Penny Bishop, a microbiologist at the University of New Mexico, suggested rock-eating bacteria may play a role in distributing essential nutrients to plant and animal life. Tectonic processes are essential for recycling nutrients on Earth, she said. Tectonic processes are critical. You can't have a biosphere without recycling. Instead of relying on volcanoes and earthquakes to distribute minerals and nutrients, Bishop suggested unique rock-eating bacteria could be injected into the ground. Bishop said the rock-eating bacteria are so voracious, they could easily churn the Martian soil. They are so rapid that you can walk through passages and rocks are raining down from above, she said. It would produce the same benefits as tectonics without tectonics. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com. Previous Change Surfer radio programs can be listened to from www.changesurfer.com and streaming MP3, thanks to the Radio for All project.